Hello and welcome to a very special Booker Prize edition of Read On. The broadcast of this show starts at 8 p.m. We're recording it a little bit earlier in the day, but in an hour and a half's time, we should know who has won this year's Man Booker Prize. I'm Robert Kirkwood.
And I'm Red Sale.
And together we'll go through the whole of the shortlist. We have five of the shortlisted authors coming up. One of them doesn't like to give interviews, but Red read her book. Here he is with a review of Milkman.
Milkman by Anna Burns is set in an unnamed city, populated for the most part by unnamed people, where to be interesting is dangerous, even deadly. Middle sister, the protagonist, is busy trying to keep her head down, usually buried in a book. And she's intent on keeping her mother in the dark about her maybe boyfriend. But when first brother-in-law starts spreading gossip about her encounter with Milkman, a prominent local paramilitary leader, life for middle sister begins to get rather too interesting for comfort.
The day Somebody McSomebody put a gun to my breast and called me a cat and threatened to shoot me was the same day the milkman died. He had been shot by one of the state hit squads, and I did not care about the shooting of this man. Others did care, though, and some were those who, in the parlance, knew me to see but not to speak to. And I was being talked about because there was a rumour started by them, or more likely by first brother-in-law, that I had been having an affair with this milkman, and that I was 18 and he was 41. I knew his age not because he got shot and it was given by the media, but because there had been talk before this, for months before the shooting, by these people of the rumour, that 41 and 18 was disgusting. The 23 years difference was disgusting. That he was married and not to be fooled by me, for there were plenty of quiet, unnoticeable people who took a bit of watching.
Milkman, written by Anna Burns and narrated by Brid Bren, is TB24450. The unnamed city closely resembles Belfast in the late 1970s, where Burns grew up. However, it could be any town riven by sectarian violence. It's a hair-trigger society where paranoia rules every aspect of daily life, right down to which brand of butter you buy. Individuality is suspect. Speaking out against your elders and betters unwise, and questioning the prevailing orthodoxy is likely to put you beyond the pale and in the way of severe punishment. Against this background, 18-year-old middle sister has little hope of withstanding the unwanted approaches of Milkman, who's old enough to be her father. But although the subject matter is deadly serious, Milkman is also a darkly funny novel, full of gallows humour and characters with all too familiar foibles. Like all good satirists, Anna Burns, who prefers not to give interviews, holds a distorting mirror up to the darker side of human behaviour to mock and reform it. And so she raises her very individual voice against sectarianism the world over.
Thanks, Red. Milkman, like all the books on the shortlist, is available from RNIB in Braille, giant print and as audio, thanks to a partnership between RNIB and the Booker Foundation, without whom this show would not be possible. Now, our first author of the evening, Red Sale, talks to the youngest person on the list, Daisy Johnson.
At 27 years old, Daisy Johnson is the youngest author ever to have been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Her book, Everything Under, is a spooky and sometimes chilling story about a young woman who was abandoned by her mother when she was a teenager. Gretel is now looking after her mother, who has dementia, and feels compelled to find out what led to their separation. However, like the monster that lives in the river, the bonnock, some things are best left undisturbed. Daisy joined me down the line from her home in Oxford. Daisy Johnson, welcome to RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you for having me. Really good to be here.
Did it come as a huge surprise to you to be shortlisted for the Booker Prize?
Yes. being longlisted was surprise enough. And then, being shortlisted was an enormous surprise. Very exciting, but quite a strange experience.
And this is your debut novel, isn't it? It's a follow-up to a collection of short stories called Fen. Are you a bit sick and tired of being labelled the youngest ever shortlisted author for the Man Booker Prize?
Yeah, I think there are more exciting things about the list than my being young. Obviously, it's very exciting for me, having my debut novel shortlisted. But I do think there are more things to talk about than that.
One of those things is, at the end of the book, you acknowledge your debt to the Greek playwright Sophocles. And actually, there's a couple of books in this year's shortlist that owe quite a debt to Greek mythology. Why do you think we've got a renewed interest in British literature at the moment with that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's been a really good year of retellings and of sort of looking back. And I think it's maybe because these are such universal stories. You know, they're set such a long time ago, but even now they're very relevant to what's happening in the world. I also think, particularly for me, the reason I love retellings is because it's an act of destruction. It's, you know, destroying something and then rebuilding it, which I've always found really interesting.
Also, I did wonder if, as the title of the book implies, you're looking for the betrayal, the terrible act that happened in the past and is being played out in current generations. Is that maybe a millennial trope, do you think?
Oh, interesting. I've never thought of it that way. But certainly I think it's a book about trauma and how trauma comes back around, and I suppose about whether we can forgive.
Do you think there is a lot to forgive the older generations to your own for? Maybe betrayals of a political nature or spending all the money and leaving you guys in debt?
Yeah, I suppose there is. I try and not think about it that way. You know, I think we're sort of all in it together now. And that there's not, you know, as much as my book's looking back, I think there's also, it's really important to just, you know, look forward and look now and, you know, work out how we can get ourselves out of this mess.
Gretel, your protagonist, is a lexicographer. She's looking for the meaning and history in words. And she displays that very much also in her relationship with her mother. There's a need to understand what's happened to her, why she's been put in care, the family history. And yet there's also a horror at turning over the stone and seeing what lies underneath.
Yes, I think she's a really interesting character. I really enjoyed writing her. And when I, you know, she wasn't a lexicographer to begin with. And then when I decided that was what she was going to do, it really made sense, because it's a book about how the language we speak makes us the people we are. And when she was younger, they created a language, and that's made her into this person who, you know, is always wants to know but can't quite stand to, you know, she's a loner, she's isolated.
And it's also a study in inversion, that Gretel is now the carer for her mother, who is in the early stages of dementia, which is the inversion of the mother who should have been looking after the daughter.
Yeah, and I think she feels that really strongly, that, you know, a couple of times throughout the book she says, this is not what's supposed to happen. Parents aren't supposed to leave their children. Parents are supposed to look after, they're supposed to look after their children. It's not supposed to be the other way around. And I think she's happy to look after her mother, but she does feel betrayed. You know, illogically, she feels betrayed also by her mother becoming sick. And it's not a relationship that luckily I've personally experienced. So it's something that I had to research a lot. There's a really good book by Iris Murdoch's husband about what it was like when she got dementia. And it's such a complicated relationship, I think, because this person, you know, who you love is someone different.
And yet, I suppose, under everything, that degeneration, that loss of parents to the child is what is going to happen to all of us. It's somewhat like original sin. It's there in the background. It's just sometimes we don't turn over the stone to see what's there because it's too frightening.
Yeah, that's right. There's something mythic about it, I suppose, in that way that, everything is circular. And I think that by the end of the book, Gretel has realised that and has, to some extent, come to peace with that.
It makes a fantastic audiobook. Were you involved at all in the recording of it and the choosing of the narrator?
I wasn't. I'm really excited to listen to it, actually. A couple of friends have listened to it and said it's really, really great.
Did you read the book out aloud to yourself?
Initially in my head, but then especially in later drafts, I think it's really important to read out loud. This book in particular is a lot about, you know, the sounds of words and the sound of the landscape, the sound of the water. So it was really important to get the right rhythm in the sentences and to get the sort of flow of it.
You say flow. It's a book that is centred around water. They lived on a canal boat. The Bonarch, the creature that travels by water, that's underneath the surface, is very much central to the plot. And also your first collection of stories, Fen, was very much water-based. What is it about water that fascinates you?
It's hard to say. It's such an unconscious thing. But so I grew up around the Fens, which is this sort of strange landscape which was drained to become farmland. So I think in the Fens there's always this feeling of water once having been there. And perhaps it was that, you know, has put this interest of water into me. The water in everything under is different. It's you know, it's river water, it's canal water, it's murky, there's things hidden in there. And I think that's what I really loved about writing about water for this book, is that just that idea that there could be anything underneath the surface, and that, you know, the human world is kind of, it can't control the water. The water has a life of its own.
So is there a water theme to whatever you're working on next?
Interestingly, so it's by the sea, but the water isn't quite as important. There's still bits of it. It still threads throughout, but it's not as present as it is in Everything Under and Fen.
Well, I hope that being shortlisted for the Man Booker means that a lot more people are going to dip into Everything Under. Are you excited for the ceremony?
Really excited, yeah. I'm really looking forward to it.
And have you read the competition?
I have. I've just finished the last of the books, which was The Overstory. Yeah, it's been one of the best things about it, actually, is just sitting down and working my way through. And they're really fantastic. I've really enjoyed them.
Well, I hope the night is great fun for you. I suppose I have to be impartial, but I will wish you as much luck as everybody else. And Daisy Johnson, thank you so much for being a guest on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much.
Everything Under by Daisy Johnson is available in Braille, giant print, and as a talking book from the RNIB Library.
Thanks for that, Red. You're listening to a very hastily put together edition of Read On, featuring the Man Booker shortlist, due to be announced in the next hour or so.
Richard Powers is an award-winning American author whose works explore the effects of modern science and technology. He describes his latest novel, The Overstory, as being all about trees, as he told Robert Kirkwood.
If someone who hasn't read it yet, give us an overview of The Overstory.
It's a book about trees and people and the deep, deep connections between them. I set in motion the lives of nine characters who come from very different backgrounds and who have very different temperaments and personal histories, but all of whom are in some way ambushed by trees. And in particular, many of them come together to take part in what we in North America call the Timber Wars, as the activity, the environmental activism in the late 90s and early 2000s, to try to prevent the cutting of the last few remnants of old-growth forest in North America.
That's one thing we don't get if we consume the audio version, is the cover of the book. I know there are different covers in different regions, but the one I'm looking at is that a painting of those forests of old?
So you must be looking at the North American cover, which is a painting by Albert Bierstadt, who was a great pioneer for landscape painting in the western part of the United States in the 19th century. And what we've done is manipulate that picture to be reminiscent of tree rings. But there's something striking in the image that I truly love. This is an image of the big trees, sequoias, in California that Bierstadt was among the first Europeans to see in the middle part of the 19th century. What I love about the picture is you can be looking at this glorious forest and this wonderful brown and green tonal register, and only belatedly realize that there are two tiny human figures in the center of the painting on horseback, and then you notice that this enormous sequoia tree that's lying dead on its side on the forest floor towers above even these men on horseback, that the width of the tree is so enormous that it rises above their head, even in death.
I remember seeing a postcard years ago of a car driving through a tunnel that had been carved in the root of a tree.
Yeah, and depending on the particular tree, they actually did cut tunnels in a few of these giant sequoias. Your particular tree may or may not last because for some reason, if you take a 3,000-year-old tree and cut the middle out of it, it doesn't last a very long time afterwards. There's some kind of metaphor for human indifference or interference in those fables. But there are two species of gigantic tree that still exist in California, the sequoia and the coastal redwood. These are ancient venerable trees. It's not unusual among the larger trees that they get to, say, even 10 meters in width and 100 meters tall. And, of course, you know, 1,500 years or older, you know, the sequoias can actually be greater than 3,000 years. So these are just stupendous and spectacular trees. And my characters, as was I when I discovered this, are just completely astounded to think that human beings are still cutting them down, even though 98% of the old growth forest and a good 95% of the redwood forest did fall under the axe after the arrival of the Europeans.
Has writing the book made you look at the wooden objects in your life in a different way?
It absolutely has. 6 years ago, when I started the book, I was pretty much oblivious to trees. I took them for granted. I might appreciate them as aesthetic objects or be grateful for their shade on a hot day. But I wasn't one who could tell the difference between an elm tree and an ash tree. And writing this story and immersing myself in the lives of trees and the agency of trees and the incredibly rich, complicated behavior and society of trees over 6 years has made me see not just living trees in a different way and the forest as a different kind of entity than I realized it was. But as you say, all the human artifacts that we make that derive from trees with a new kind of reverence and awe. And it's not an exaggeration, as one of my characters says, when you begin to list the amount of derivatives and artifacts and objects that we still make from, you know, either wood directly or from cellulose and lignin, you know, the components of trees, to say, it's not an exaggeration to say that we're still living in the age of wood.
You say in the book that the trees live a quiet existence, but it's a quiet existence that's really hiding an industry of keeping themselves alive.
Yes. You know, many of the forests in Britain and in Europe and now in North America have been converted to agricultural purposes, to forestry, to what amounts to tree farms or tree plantations. And in part, we've perhaps justified the use of these creatures as resources because we haven't fully understood just how complicated trees are, how social they are, and how rich a forest ecosystem can be. And we have perhaps been mistaken in believing that trees will always grow back and that no matter how we treat them, they will return. And it was sobering for me to realize as I wrote the book that, in fact, no human being has ever seen an old-growth forest, a rich, complicated, interconnected ecosystem of the kind that exists when a forest is allowed to reach full maturity over the course of millennia. No one has ever seen a clear cut come back to that same degree of richness. So part of the book is to open the eyes of readers, as my characters' eyes are opened, to the majesty and the astonishment and the richness and complexity of the neighbors, of the creatures that have made our civilization
And the fact that in the book and in research I've read it elsewhere, the trees actually communicate to each other, and it's not just elm to elm, they communicate across species as well.
Truly remarkable, and this is research that's been unfolding for a few decades now, and it's just starting to percolate into the public imagination and realization. Not only do trees signal each other over the air with chemical semaphores, chemical messages that alert, say, distant trees to an invasion, either of insects or other herbivores, but they are, as you say, connected underground by fungal filaments that will share resources and food and medicines, not just between trees of the same species, but trees of different species. And that a big, mature Douglas fir, for instance, that reaches up into the sun, can actually be sending sugars through these fungal intermediaries to, say, a rather small birch that's been stunted for many decades because it's, you know, it's in a dark, heavily shaded understory. And this notion that, you know, our understanding as nature, of nature as being primarily a competitive phenomenon, red in tooth and claw, as Tennyson says, has to be revised, and that we have to realize that for every act of competition, that there are many, many acts of cooperation going on in a forest. It's this notion that lies at the heart of a book that's essentially a plea for human beings to realize that they, too, are not exceptional and are not separate creatures, but are richly connected and imbricated and reciprocally beholden to, you know, to all kinds of other living things.
There's a character in the book with a sensory disability. It's hearing, it's not sight loss, but that initial isolation that she feels will resonate with a lot of our listeners.
Yes. This is a character named Patricia, and she has a hearing impediment when she's young, and consequently her speech is not particularly easy to understand, and her schoolmates tease her mercilessly and isolate her, and she's a bit bewildered by humans because of this this barrier between her and her peers. It's her father who takes her under his wing and teaches her about the richness of the non-human world, and she finds some consolation in having the society of green things open to her, where the society of human beings has remained a kind of tough mystery for her to crack. She tells her father one day that she's astonished that her schoolmates can't tell the difference between one kind of tree and another, and how can that possibly be when they're surrounded by these rich and marvelous things? And her father says, you know, that's Adam's curse. It's a sad thing, but we human beings tend to struggle to identify with or understand anything that doesn't look and feel and behave just like us.
Thanks again to Richard Powers. Just a note that these interviews that we're playing tonight are edited versions, so they'll all fit in the 1 hour. The full versions are available on our Audioboom page. There's a big link at rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or simply go to audioboom.com and search for RNIB Talking Books. And next up on our list of Man Booker shortlisted authors, Essie Adugin.
Essie Adugin is a Canadian author whose works reflect her own global perspective. Her second novel, Half Blood Blues, was shortlisted for the 2011 Man Booker Prize and features a mixed-race jazz musician abducted in Nazi Germany. Her latest novel, Washington Black, is another historical novel that ranges across continents. And it's inspired by a true story, as I found out when I spoke to her via Skype from her home in British Columbia. Essie Adugin, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here.
For readers who haven't yet read Washington Black, could you give us a little bit of background to the story?
So Washington Black is a novel set in the 1830s, and it's about an 11-year-old field slave called Washington Black, who was born on a plantation in the Caribbean, and he's known no other life. It's he has been a slave his entire life. He has rarely known a kindness from anyone, and so he's quite shocked to find himself taken to live in the quarters of his new master's brother, who's a man called Christopher, or Titch, Wild. You know, Washington is horrified by the prospect of going to live with this man, but he soon finds that Titch is completely different from every other white man that he's ever known. Titch is a gentleman scientist, so he's a naturalist, he's an inventor, he's an illustrator, but he's also an abolitionist. And it's really through his taking Wash out of his situation in the fields that Washington comes to have a greater sense of himself as a fully realized human being. And he understands that he too has gifts to offer the world.
And you were inspired to write the story by a real life story. I believe it's based in part on the longest running legal case in British history.
Yeah, so it's the Tichborne claimant trials. They started in the 1860s and ran all throughout then and all throughout the 1870s, and were indeed the longest running series of criminal trials in the British courts until like the 1980s. And essentially what happened was the scion of a very wealthy family from the south of England was shipwrecked at sea. He was a bit of a dandy and had been making a pleasure tour and ended up being shipwrecked off the I think it was Argentina. But in any case, he had a very, very doting mother, and she just was so devastated and refused to believe that he had died. It just didn't seem natural to her. So she consulted a clairvoyant who assured her that her son, whose name was Roger Tichborne, was alive and well and living his life in a distant country. So what she did was put notices in newspapers and get a response back from a place called Wagga. Essentially, the gist of what the note was, mother, my life is a butcher in a small Australian town, but you know, I'm ready to come back now and take up my mantle, the head of the estates, and assume my inheritance. And she was utterly delighted, but she was utterly convinced that it was him. But just in case it wasn't, she thought that she would dispatch somebody to go out and make the identification. And just by chance, one of the household servants, who'd worked at the Tichborne estate for 40 years, he had retired recently to Sydney, Australia. So it was very convenient for her to consult him and ask him to go see if it was indeed Roger living in Wagga. And this man's name was Andrew Bogle. And he was an ex-slave who had been stolen off of a plantation in the Caribbean by Sir Edward Tichborne, a member of the Tichborne household, who had been doing a bit of work, I guess, at a friend's plantation and had seen this young man and decided to take him away and steal him away. And Bogle lived out most of his life in England as a servant for the family and had a whole new life. And so when I was approaching the claimant trials, I really wanted to depict them through Bogle's eyes. But as I sat down to write them, I realized that I was kind of less interested in all of the many, many, many details of the trial that just went on for decades. And I was much more interested in the psychology of somebody like Bogle, who had been, born and raised in very brutal circumstances and would have felt like everything in his life was preordained and that he would likely die on the plantation. So to be removed from that very suddenly and taken to a place that was so radically different from everything he had known was interested in how that would manifest itself, in his psyche and what that would do to him and what kind of trauma he was still carrying with him forward into these new years of his life.
And like your previous two novels, it's very much a book about aftermath, about rebuilding one's life after terrible events and trying to find happiness and fulfillment in a world that is set against you.
Exactly. And trying to kind of reestablish, your own identity, just trying to find your foothold in the world and to create, really, Washington has to recreate his sense of self, which has been so, trampled upon for his early years. He really has to figure out who he is as a person and, accept that he too has rights in the world. And he really has to develop a sense of agency and taking control of his life and accepting that certain things are within his grasp to change, but then there are things that will forever lay outside of his grasp, and that being physically free is, his physical freedom maybe doesn't open him up to every other type of freedom that he imagined that it would.
And that experiment that Washington constructs with his making of his own new life is mirrored in the scientific experiments that are going on around him, initially with his master Titch, who is fascinated by flight, and then with an exploration of marine biology. You're clearly also fascinated by early scientific discovery during the 19th century.
Yes, very. It was something where I discovered I was fascinated by it almost by accident. It was, I was feeling my way through the novel, trying to really get a sense of Washington's character, what his interests would be, what he would be leaning towards. And then I just started reading about, historical science and naturalism and the first environmentalists and discovering how they went about classifying specimens, and I realized I had a very deep interest in this, and it really took over the second half of the novel, and it was a real pleasure to get to write about that.
That pleasure really comes through, and whilst you dig deep into, both the early flight and marine biology, you never layer it on in trowelfuls. Where do you stop with research and start putting your fingers through the keyboard?
Yeah, I'm somebody who I start every book with research, because you need something to help you enter the text. And because I tend to write historical novels, it does require some background in certain things. So for Washington Black, that was reading about plantation life as it manifested itself specifically in the Caribbean, and even more specifically in Barbados. So reading deeply about that, it wasn't so much delving into the science at the very outset, but I also research as I'm writing, and this is something that helps keep my mind in the book and helps keep me interested, because I'm continually discovering new facts and able to put them into the book, or to go back and use them when I'm revising. So I'm researching from before I write until probably just before I end the book, and it's just been my process, and it's been very helpful.
Thanks again to Red and to Essie Edugin. The full interview is available on our Audioboom page. You're listening to a very hastily put together edition of Read On, celebrating the shortlisted authors on the Man Booker Prize. We're playing them in no particular order, and here's book five.
Robin Robertson is the author of The Long Take, the first work of poetry ever to be shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Set just after the Second World War, it follows the journey of Walker, a D-Day veteran with post-traumatic stress disorder, as he travels across the United States from New York to California. Just as in the movies of the era, his odyssey is framed by film noir. I began by asking Robin Robertson to tell me a bit more about Walker's journey. Robin Robertson, welcome to RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
So I've given a little portrait of the hero of the book, Walker. Could you tell us a little bit more about his journey across the United States?
Well, he's been on a number of journeys prior to the US. He was brought up in Nova Scotia, in Canada, island in the Maritimes. He then signs up for the Second World War and serves in the Normandy landings and subsequent campaigns in Europe. He returns to North America with undiagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder and with some pretty grim memories of what he's seen and done. He finds it impossible to return permanently to Nova Scotia and his sweetheart, Annie MacLeod, because of the damage, psychological damage that has occurred. And he does what a lot of returning servicemen did at that time. He goes in search of anonymity and oblivion in the big cities of the United States. So he starts off in New York, where he lives in a flop house and works in the docks, but it's too cold and miserable, and he heads west, first to Los Angeles, and then briefly to San Francisco, and then he returns to Los Angeles, where he has found some form of community. However damaged and derelict it is still a kind of home.
And you use a very interesting phrase early on in the book. Cities are a kind of war, both far away and sometimes very close. It's a very striking phrase, the boredom and then the sudden frisson of excitement and sometimes terror, which keeps calling to mind Walker's terrible experiences in the war for him.
Well, yes, the city acts as a trigger repeatedly. And that is, again, I have read a fair bit about PTSD, and cities are probably the worst place to be if you suffer from that.
And you frame it in the form of an epic poem along the lines of Homer's Odyssey or T.S. Eliot's Wasteland. Did you feel that the form lent itself to that exploration of the darker side of PTSD?
Well, to be frank, I didn't know I was writing a long narrative poem until I had it finished, nor did I know that I was going to be writing about PTSD. The genesis of the long take was probably my slight exasperation at the lyric form, wanting to try something a bit more expansive and different and something that would accommodate some of the interests that I have long had, that would also embrace the cities. I've lived all my life in pretty much latter life in cities, other than that I've never written about them. And I wanted to address some of the ambivalence I remember feeling when I moved from rural Scotland to London. And this is where I felt the worlds colliding. I was able to talk about cities, about urban paranoia, about film noir, which is a direct socio-political product of cities and paranoia, and also talk about an interesting historical moment in the United States in the post-war period, which seems to me to have remarkable parallels with America in the present day.
You mentioned film noir, and the language is very much that clipped, harsh, hard-boiled sometimes language of film noir. I understand that the book is beautifully illustrated with images taken from the era. Are they stills from film noir themselves?
No, they're just largely press photographs. of the different cities that are written about in the book.
And why do you think the late 40s was the time in the United States that gave birth to film noir?
Well, film noir was created not by Americans, although it is now regarded as one of the great American art forms, like jazz and blues. It was actually created by German refugees from Nazi Germany. They fled Hitler in the late 30s, and many of them, people like Fritz Lang or Billy Wilder, for instance, pitched up in Hollywood. And they brought with them all their sensibilities, their artistic skills, their training in German expressionist film techniques, the chiaroscuro and the low-key lighting and so on. And they also brought with them their terror at what they'd seen, unfolding in Germany. So it was an interesting mixture of skill set. And what you got was the cities on film haunted by terror. And this is what makes film noir interesting, to me at least. They are incredibly dark films about urban terror, about hopelessness, about anonymous characters disappearing within the machinery of a large faceless construction. And it was a unique vision, really, and it only lasted just over 15 years, probably, and then dissipated and died. But it has left a remarkable mark on the culture, and is still being copied or echoed today in film.
The audiobook version that I listened to and that's available in the RNIB library is deceptive. It's that wonderful form of poetry that doesn't announce itself as poetry. And I wondered if you read your work back to yourself before you send it into the publisher.
I test every line against the ear. Yes, I mean, that's what poetry is, or at least how it should be.
Are you pleased with the audiobook version? Have you heard it?
I have, yes, and Kerry Shale is a terrific voice to have on one side, and he manages to render the dialogues superbly. And what he does to get a woman's voice, I don't know. I'm glad I wasn't in the studio. But he is remarkable. Yes, I'm very pleased with it.
And I've read that you feel completely exhausted after, all used up, I think was your expression, after completing the book. Was that hyperbole, or are you going to take a rest from writing for a bit?
It wasn't hyperbole. This was a book that I could throw everything into. I mean, a lot of the lines go back 40 years. It accommodated almost everything because I hadn't been able to use much of the material in my own standard poetry for all kinds of reasons. So this was an omnium gatherum of a book, and so I clear the cupboards, and as a result, I feel slightly cleared out myself. But I'll be back to writing once I've had a bit of a rest from all this nonsense.
And now, last but not least on this Man Booker special, Robert Kirkwood talks to Rachel Kuchner.
Romy Hall, the protagonist of The Mars Room, is at the start of two consecutive life sentences at a women's correctional facility deep in California's Central Valley. Outside is the world from which she has been severed. Inside is a new reality. The Mars Room by Rachel Kuchner is read by the author.
Let's start with basics. Do you know what year it is? Doc did not know what year it was, but it dawned on him that he knew how to answer this stupid question. It's the year after last year. The doctor frowned. Do you know where you are? Doc looked around, saw nothing but a metal cart with pills in paper cups, an armed guard sitting on a chair. The room had no windows and there was nothing on the walls. He looked down at his body, saw a garment that was half a garment. His hand was plastered with tape holding a needle in. Tubes ran from his hand up to a metal stand with a bag hanging from it, half full of clear liquid. A person who must have been a nurse came in and eyed the bag, squeezed it in a way that seemed reckless, and walked out of the room. Doc's cuffed wrists were chained to the bed's metal rails. His ankles, too, were manacled to the bed rails. He had no clue where he was. All he knew was that his skull felt like it had been split in half by a concrete spillway. Icy water splashed through the spillway, pushing his brains apart.
Rachel Kushner, the author and narrator of The Mars Room. She joined me down the line via Skype and told me about the book.
The book is a contemporary novel which mostly tells the story of one young woman who speaks in the first person, although there are other characters. And it takes place in California, and in a way it's about contemporary California, but maybe a California that those outside California, and even some people who live there, don't really have to think about or see because of the way our society is so severely stratified, in that poor people who commit crimes and go to prison are almost structurally invisible to middle-class people. And this book starts with a woman who is on a bus traveling up a long stretch of highway from Los Angeles to the Central Valley, where we grow food in California. It's all industrial farming. And that's also where all the prisons are sited. And she's on her way to prisons to serve a life sentence. And as the book unfolds, she adjusts to living life in prison, and also provides the reader with significant flashbacks of material to her earlier life in San Francisco, where she grew up.
How was the research, and how was it as a writer inhabiting that character who was serving life without the possibility of parole?
Yeah, it was intense. I do a lot of volunteer work with people who are serving life sentences in prison, and that's partly how this book evolved, was that it had a natural dialogue with my actual life. And things I'm involved with separate from writing to do with, you know, I go and watch trials because I want to see who's being subjected to the justice system, who has a lawyer, who doesn't. I live right near the courts. And I did start to wonder about what happens. You know, the court is a very public place. Anyone can go and watch a trial. But once a person is convicted, they are remanded. That's the term they use, remanded to state prison. And after that, the portion of their punishment that is unseen by the public begins. And I really wanted to follow one person on that bus and up through and into prison. And because I know people who are serving life sentences and have, you know, regular dialogues with these people, I have some sense of what it's like for them. But it's a different thing to speak in the voice of someone who's experiencing that. And I wanted to force myself to do it, partly to think into what a life sentence is. It's my character doesn't have life without possibility of parole, but she has effectively that. She has two life sentences, which means you carry out the first one and you go up for parole. And if they say you've completed your sentence, then you can begin your second sentence. And it's based on a sentence that a friend of mine actually does have, a friend who has nothing to do with the character in the book. It's just a sentence, which I found sort of galling and incredible as a sentence. I did want to think into what that means. It's quite abstract to be told that the unit of your life is the segment of time that you can use to pay back the state for the harm you've committed. And it's purely subjective, because you could live for 4 years or you could live for 40 years, but that's the amount of time you need to use to give to them in order to recalibrate your wrong and make right. I mean, I don't think that they even look at it so schematically, but effectively, that's what it is. You pay back with your time, which is the only thing a lot of people have. But in writing the book, there were a lot of parts of it where mentally I wasn't inside prison, just as I assumed my character would not be, because once you go to prison, the period of life of your life where you're collecting experiences and memories from the outside world have ceased. And so I assumed it would be a time of revisiting and ruminating on those experiences, and also recounting for the reader who you are. And who you are is shaped by what happened to you before you go to prison. And people hold on to that very strongly. You know, the identity that they have is one that they've managed to acquire before they caught a case and were forced to be stripped of their identity, as the sociologist Irving Goffman would put it, you know, have their clothes taken away from them, all the things that signify a life in particularity. So she goes back in her memories and provides chapters of her childhood and adolescence in San Francisco, and then the years directly before she went to prison in Los Angeles. So that was just all kind of normal writing in a way for me, because I was telling the story of a character, and she was in a milieu that I know very well. I know it personally. She's from my neighborhood where I grew up, and her friends are, it's essentially a world that I lived. Her friends are my friends. So it wasn't that exotic for me, but also I know people from growing up who went to prison. And so in a way, the book gave me the opportunity, even if it was very dark at times, to sort out some of what happened in terms of the stark distance between different destinies. You know, when you're a child, you're at least for me as an adolescent, the world of my friends was everything. I barely saw my parents. Much as I love them, they weren't involved. I was just with this group of kids. And even when you're young, there's a feeling that people are going to go in different directions. And there were people who, you know, made a courageous stance that their life was going to be about pushing back against authority. And some of that has to do with their home life. And, you know, I had a couple of friends, or many friends, who were lost to that. And one in particular who went to prison. And the difference between what happened in his life and what happened in mine, that is painful for me. But writing the book was a way somehow of processing some of those differences and that pain. But I also tried to make it a very funny book. And that's not just to include humor and entertain people, although I do hope it does that, but because I felt like I wouldn't have been getting at the truth of the matter if I didn't find the humor. Because it's just not all misery and crying all the time. People are very funny and resourceful in prison. It's a very lively place. And I think there are reasons for that. Like, your personality is one of the only forms of currency you have in prison, since everything is taken away from you. Some people have money on their books, you know, to shop at the canteen. Many people don't. They have their ability to cajole and persuade and seduce and entertain and threaten and manipulate. So personality is a premium. And I've found people to be incredibly funny. In my own life, the people I knew who were always getting arrested and having to deal with the criminal justice system, and the people I know who are there now, there's always room for humor. I mean, even as your options reduce down, then that becomes your life. And there are people who are still willing to insult a cop to get a few laughs out of their peers, even if it means getting thrown into administrative segregation. And so I needed to tap into that kind of humor. It was really important to me, because if I wasn't doing it, I wasn't tapping into the truth of the place.
Yeah, I like the description of the actual Mars room. If you showered, you had a competitive edge. If your tattoos weren't misspelled, you were hot property.
Oh, well, yeah, that's the club that she worked at. It's actually kind of based on a place in San Francisco that doesn't exist anymore that was very much like that. Like, the girls who worked there always thought John Waters should come and film a movie there because he could find a natural set of characters.
Now, you narrated the audio version of the book. How was that process?
It was really fun. I really wanted to do it. I hadn't narrated my previous two books. there's something about the delivery of a professional narrator that's just quite different than the delivery of an author. And probably there are people out there who prefer the professional narrators. It's very slick and smooth, and they change intonation when they speak from the voice of a different character. But I like things read by the author if the author is a good reader. I felt with this book like I really wanted to do the narration, partly because over the last year that I was editing it, I was reading sentences out loud, because the sentences are somewhat vocal. They're short, they're syncopated, they're declarative. Romy has a kind of tough tone, and I knew how each line should be delivered. I mean, at least by me, if I were narrating, I felt like I could do it.
Thanks to Robert and to Rachel Kuchner.
And just a note that that was an edited version of that interview. Like many of the interviews this evening, in order to cram them all into an hour, we've had to cut bits out. The full versions are available on our Audioboom page. Just go to audioboom.com and search for R&IB Talking Books.
So there you have it, all six of the books in contention for the 2018 Man Booker Prize.
And if you're listening to this on Freeview 7:30, we'll know the result in about half an hour's time. I may put the podcast up a wee bit earlier. Now, who do you think is going to win?
That was going to be my question to you. Well, I must say, I hope it's going to be Essie Adujan. It's a real page-turner of a historical novel, and I think it's probably the one that I would be most likely to give to a friend for Christmas. But I know you've got a favourite too.
I've got a couple of favourites. You always favour the authors that you've interviewed yourself, and this year I did Richard Powers and Rachel Kushner. And historically, it's always been the last person we interview, I think, that wins it. Certainly was the case last year with George Saunders and Lincoln in the Bardo, so I've got a wee sneaky tenor on Rachel Kushner.
Well, traditionally it's been one of the authors that you interview rather than me. I know that the bookies are hotly tipping Richard Powers to be the third American in a row to win the Man Booker Prize, which, since they were only allowed in to the competition in 2016, would be quite a feat.
But I don't think the bookie's favourite ever really wins the Booker Prize.
Well, then again, what do we know, Robert? We just interview the authors.
And we'll find out the result in half an hour's time. Thank you for listening to this very hastily put together edition of Read On.
And we'll be back on Friday with a brand new show, so don't forget to tune in.
Thanks for listening, and remember to read on.